This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Here's the credit crunch for you in one easy sentence. Nobody knows how much all the loans and bonds Wall Street has outstanding are really worth. Not even the slightest clue. So the news today from Citigroup that it might be unloading $12 billion worth of debt, if that's what it's really worth, was a welcome development indeed. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Wednesday, the 9th of April. Good to have you with us. Yes, it is a stretch to try to define what's kept the credit market seized up for the better part of a year in just one sentence. But honestly, it's not that far from the truth. If nobody can figure out what the other guy's debt is worth, why in the world would they buy any of it? And if they don't buy, the next person doesn't buy, and so on it goes. The news reports today about Citigroup are, we should tell you, unconfirmed, but the buzz is that it's close to selling $12 billion in loans it desperately wants to get off its books. The bad news for Citigroup is that the bank is said to be selling for a sizable loss. The good news for the rest of us is that it's another sign of a thaw in the frozen credit markets. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
Before now, no one's been sure exactly what this troubled corporate debt is worth, but these investments have never really been a total loss for the banks that hold the IOUs as assets. Investment manager William Smith believes many investors have taken a dire outlook that goes too far.
Right now, there's the Armageddon scenario within the financial sector that we just don't see playing out.
Federal accounting rules have forced banks to write down big losses on paper for these hard-to-sell assets, loans made to big takeover firms to fund leverage buyouts. Now, a trio of private equity firms reportedly agrees they're worth just under 90 cents on the dollar, considerably more than the value the banks have been declaring.
They need to get it off the books, so they're willing to take a 10% haircut, which is actually better than what they're showing on the books right now, which is a 20% haircut.
Much like a home buyer waiting out a seller, big investors have been holding out for the best price, and credit sites analyst Chris Taggart says the pool of capital has been growing.
What we haven't seen is we haven't seen it flow into the market yet in any meaningful size, and this would be the first example of a large pool of capital moving into the market to take advantage of the low prices.
Some analysts are hopeful this is the first step toward the rest of the credit market thawing out, but Douglas McIntyre, a market commentator for the website 24/7 Wall Street, is skeptical mortgage-backed securities will fare as well.
All the other assets that Citi holds, that Lehman holds, there isn't any evidence that those are bottoming.
In fact, he says there are fresh predictions of even deeper write-downs. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
It was kind of a roll of the dice for passengers scheduled on American Airlines today. For the third time in as many weeks, the country's biggest carrier canceled a sizable chunk of its flights, more than 1,000 of them, about 45% of its regular schedule. Maintenance was once again the culprit. American said it's inspecting the wiring in its fleets of MD-80s. The company insists it's not a safety issue, it's just complying with requirements from the Federal Aviation Administration. Either way, though, it's expensive for the airline and for its passengers. From New York, Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
In recent weeks, Congress has criticized the FAA for being too cozy with some of the airlines it oversees. Darrell Jenkins is an independent airline consultant. He says American's latest flight cancellations have come about because the FAA wants to emphasize its independence.
they need to show Congress right now that they can be tough. The fact that it's inconveniencing tens of thousands of travelers is of no consequence.
He says the FAA could have carried out the inspections over weeks without severely disrupting Americans' flights. But the FAA says it only found out recently that American had not properly inspected its planes back in March. Joe Brancatelli runs business travel website joesentme.com.
The Federal Aviation Administration does not have this vast crew of white-coated inspectors who do inspections of planes. What the FAA does is look at airline paperwork.
Meanwhile, American is losing millions. Darrell Jenkins again.
For an MD-80 fleet, each plane carries $15,000 to $20,000 worth of revenue. That's a lot of money for an airline right now. And with everything else, this is adding up to a pretty significant bill for them.
Everything else includes putting stranded passengers up in hotels, feeding them, and paying for them to fly on other airlines. American says the financial fallout could emerge next week when the airline reports its results. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
The other aviation news of the day came not from an airline, but from the country's biggest maker of commercial jets. Boeing announced the third delay of its 787 Dreamliner. Boeing's bet a good deal of money the plane will change air travel as we know it, which may in fact turn out to be true, but we're going to have to wait an extra 15 months to find out. The company says the outsourced manufacturing process it's using for the 787 is causing the delays. There was no delay in the rise of oil prices today. Crude shot up to an all-time high in New York, $112.21 a barrel, closed just shy of $111. Worries not over oil but over corporate profits spooked Wall Street today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Seeing as how this is a political year, how's this for a question to introduce a story? Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? The Pew Research Center released a survey today that said for most Americans in the middle class, the answer is no, and not necessarily for anything having to do with presidential politics. David Leonhardt's an economics columnist for The New York Times. Good to have you with us.
It's good to be here.
As we stand back and survey the boom that was, that ended last year at some point, it's becoming clear now that it was different in many, many ways from previous booms, one of which was that not everybody really kept up, right?
That's right. I mean, for most people, it wasn't really a boom worthy of the name. Essentially, for as long as we have records, when there have been economic expansions, people have gotten raises, which is to say their pay has increased more quickly than inflation. Their buying power has grown. It's happened in every economic expansion since World War II until the current one or the now past one. Between 2000 and 2007, the typical family did not actually get a raise. Median family income was $61,000 adjusted for inflation in 2000, and it's a little less than that right now. And that's really remarkable.
What happened?
Well, a lot of things happened. It's hard to draw one direct line between cause and effect, but starting in about the 1970s, the economy seems to have changed. People typically date it to the oil shock of the early to mid-70s, 1973. And all sorts of things started to change. For one thing, oil made the price of everyday living more expensive. And then we had these revolutions in technology and in globalization, and they brought a lot of benefits, but they also made it harder for many workers to get raises. They essentially reduced the bargaining power of large numbers of workers because it was easier for them to be replaced by a machine or easier for their job to go somewhere else.
Is it people falling out of the middle class?
Well, that's not quite right, meaning incomes are not falling. It's just that they're not rising. And so while there are certainly some number of people falling out of the middle class, there seem to be a roughly equal number of people coming into the middle class. The problem really now is that we're not growing the middle class in the way we want to be. The way we want to grow the middle class is have people from what we might consider below the middle class move into it. And it seems that we're not doing that. And for as long as we have records, that's never been true.
Is it a case of us having set the bar too high? I mean, for 50 years, every year, people have been doing better and better and better.
Yeah, that's a fair question. I think it's important not necessarily to say that we want to have the same kind of income gains that we had in the 1950s and 60s, which was a somewhat closed and in many ways false economy. But I do think that to say that we want living standards to rise, to say that we want most people to be getting raises, I don't think that's too high a bar. And the reason is that the economy is still growing. And when the economy is still growing, by definition, the whole pie is growing. The problem is that the number of people who are benefiting from it is now very, very narrow. It seems to be something like roughly the top 5% of the income distribution.
You pointed out in your column in the paper today that it really doesn't matter who's been in the White House. This trend of ever-increasing standards has continued. Question I have to leave you with then is, what happens for the next president? What's the fix?
Well, we often like to think of the United States economy as this laissez-faire economy. And relative to some of the economies of continental Europe, we are much more open, and that has had numerous benefits. But we are not just a free market economy. We built the interstate highway system. We built the internet. These are all government intervention in the economy. And it seems that we are going to need some kind of new government intervention, whether it's smarter, better funding of schools, not just more funding, but smarter funding, whether it's something like a huge alternative energy project that tries to create more middle-class jobs. Something isn't working right now, and it's been going on long enough that I don't think we should fool ourselves into thinking that it's just a blip.
David Leonhardt writes the Economic Scene column for the New York Times. David, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks for having me.
One of the perks of serving the federal government in a senior position is that you get to tell the world how much you're worth, who's paying you, what kind of investments you have, those kinds of things. Financial disclosure forms, of course, have been around for decades, and pretty much everybody who has to fill one out is over whatever privacy concerns they might have had. But all those records have now been posted online to a fully searchable internet database on a website called Legistorm. From Washington, Jeremy Hobson reports.
Jock Friedley started Legistorm to shine some light on Congress. He added the personal financial disclosures of Capitol Hill staffers in February, mostly those who draw a congressional salary of more than $110,000 a year.
There are many, many staffers who are more powerful than most members of Congress. Almost anybody on the Appropriations Committee has control over enormous sums of money.
So, he says, their personal conflicts of interest are as important as their bosses. Gifts from lobbyists, for example, stocks held in companies staffers help regulate, or even an extra salary.
I found a staffer who is a trade policy counsel, a very important person in the Senate, who received money on the side as a lawyer for a trade policy organization.
But Jeff Loving isn't convinced staffer financial information is relevant. He's chief of staff for Congressman Bill Schuster.
I don't have a problem with disclosure. I just have a problem with the inability to be able to see where my data is going.
He says in the old paper system, he could keep track of those who peeked into his financial disclosures. Now, anyone with a screen name can do it. Still, Melanie Sloan with Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington says the staff complaints are over the top.
Everybody knows when they take those jobs that they are going to be filling out those financial disclosure forms every year and that they are publicly available.
Sloan says ultimately the public's right to know should trump privacy concerns. House lawyers are said to be looking for a happy medium. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
And now, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial slid a third of 1%, 49 points, to close at 12,527 today. The Nasdaq sliced off 1/10%, 26 points, ended the day at 2322. The S&P 500 was off 0.8%, 11 points, to finish at 1354. UPS shares reversed 3.75% after the shipping giant lowered earnings estimates amid record-high gas prices and, oh yeah, a weaker economy. FedEx, another economic bellwether, fell in line. Its shares backed up more than 3%. Worries over write-downs sank financial stocks yet again. Citigroup shares were down 0.75%. Goldman Sachs sheared off more than 2.5% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note dropped to 3.48%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Advanta. Advanta salutes small business, the brave ones, the risk takers, all those who chase a dream and make their own way.
and by Lions for Lambs, starring Tom Cruise, Meryl Streep, and Robert Redford, on DVD today. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com. Every day's marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Commerce Department releases the trade balance report for February. The Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee discusses ways to alleviate the foreclosure crisis. And a House committee investigates the sale of sensitive military equipment and supplies on the Internet. Officials explain how they were able to purchase and make deals online during an undercover investigation. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. General David Petraeus was back before Congress today. This time it was on the House side of the rotunda. The U.S. commander in Iraq repeated his warning against pulling U.S. troops out too soon. But that wasn't necessarily the answer to lawmakers' questions. If you listen closely, more and more of the conversation is about the dollars and cents cost of the war. Commentator Robert Reich says as big a number as that is right now, it's going to hurt us more in the future.
Contrary to what some are saying, the cost of the war in Iraq, so far estimated to total somewhere between $1 and $3 trillion, is not responsible for the economic mess we're in. Wars can cause inflation when a nation's resources are already fully committed, as when Lyndon Johnson escalated the war in Vietnam at the same time he was mounting a war on poverty. But when a nation's resources are underutilized, wars have been known to get economies back on track, as we learned when Franklin D. Roosevelt took the nation to war in 1941. The economic expansion that began in 2001 was anemic, as expansions go, so the American economy has had enough capacity to support a war in Iraq without igniting inflation. Most inflation pressures now are coming from abroad, from higher oil and commodity prices. And while unrest in the Middle East has contributed to that inflation, defenders of the war say that oil prices would be even higher now and in the future were we not in Iraq. With the U.S. economy falling into recession, we have even more unused capacity, but that's not in itself a reason for continuing to spend billions of dollars on the Iraqi war. The war is a terribly inefficient way to stimulate the U.S. economy. A dollar spent on repairing a bridge in Iraq doesn't have nearly the multiplier effect on our economy as a dollar spent repairing a bridge here in the United States. More to the point, a dollar spent there is a dollar we do not have to spend here, not only repairing our own bridges, roads, and water and sewage systems, but also giving Americans access to health insurance and children access to good schools, fully funding Social Security and Medicare, investing adequately in non-carbon-based energy sources and green technologies, and borrowing less from abroad. In other words, the real economic cost of the Iraqi war doesn't show up in the business cycle. It will show up years from now in a standard of living that for most Americans will be significantly lower than we might have enjoyed because we spent trillions on a war in Iraq rather than investing here in America.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His latest book is called Super Capitalism. Share your thoughts with us at our website. It's marketplace.org. Take a look around the global economy, all of it, from retail sales to manufacturing and transportation. The World Bank says global gross domestic product comes to about $48 trillion. Add maybe another $8 or $9 trillion if you want to have some idea of how much daily commerce happens illegally. Best estimates are that about 15 to 20% of the world's economy is off the books. Illegal trafficking drives all kinds of businesses, from cigarette smuggling to heroin and people. Journalist Misha Glenny takes a tour of the underground economy in his new book, McMafia. He says it's able to flourish today thanks in part to free trade and globalization.
That success also coincided in 1989 with the collapse of communism. and the temporary devastation of states all over Eastern Europe. In their place, there were these very awkward things, the transitional states, which started to produce things, produce goods and services, some of which are entirely legitimate, some of which we call illicit goods and services. And with the increased flows in trade and capital, it became much easier for us to get our hands on those things and for the gangsters from the transitional states in particular to provide us with them.
You spent a lot of time talking about Russia and about the Balkans. What about other failed states? And I'm thinking now specifically of Iraq and what's going on there and how that relates to security and the economic roots of what might be happening.
Well, Iraq is very interesting because if you look at the surveys of ordinary Iraqis of what distresses them most of all, their major concerns, consistently over the years since 2003, the issue of security has been joint top with the issue of corruption. People who live in neighboring Amman, the capital of Jordan, for example, know it full well because a lot of the money which is being siphoned off into people's pockets from the oil industry in particular has gone into buying property in Amman, which of course is relatively secure. And so people in Jordan have seen house prices go up really quite dramatically as a consequence of corrupt money from the oil industry in Iraq coming into their country, displacing Jordanians from their houses and generally disrupting that economy. I mean, aside from everything else, Iraq has created a tremendous criminal sub-economy since 2003 in the Middle East. And you see this replicated in many places, particularly where there's conflict, but also when you see a dramatic upsurge in economic activity.
What, if any, is the United States' role in all this?
From the mid-1990s onwards, there was an attempt to start looking at particular at the banking industry around the world, because if you can get hold of gangsters' money, then you're doing them real damage. When the Bush administration came in, the first thing it did was start trying to dismantle this regulatory system because it argued that it was damaging to the competitiveness of American banks. Then you get 9/11, and the Bush administration turns around and said, where was that money coming from? And so you started the laborious process again of trying to build up a regulatory regime.
I don't want to belabor the obvious, but the American financial system these days is having its own troubles, and Ben Bernanke and Henry Paulson and the gang in Washington are busy trying to figure out how to keep it from collapsing. Forget about organized crime.
Absolutely. And one of the things which I find very, very distressing is when global banks like BNP Paribas in France admits that it itself is unable to calculate the extent of its losses in the subprime fiasco. Now, when we've got that situation where the banks actually are unable to keep track of what money is where, it's a golden age for people who want to get money from the illicit economy, dirty money, and clean it through these very, very confused systems.
The latest book by Misha Glenny is called McMafia, A Journey Through the Global Criminal Underworld. Mr. Glenny, thanks for your time.
You're more than welcome. Thank you.
Every year, more advertising moves online. Everything from employment ads to personals can be had on the internet now. As we've all heard, the lost revenue is killing newspapers. And now there's a new website that could put another nail in the newspaper coffin. From WBUR in Boston, Kurt Nickish reports now on the coming demise of the newspaper death notice.
In a photo on a website, Ruth Fallon is standing on the porch of the Massachusetts home where she lived for most of her 85 years. Her face is turned to the sun.
Well, it's not one of her real smiles, but I just like it because she was a lovely woman. She was a beautiful woman.
Jill Fallon is her daughter. She published this photo online, along with stories of her mother's battle with cancer and the eulogy she gave at Ruth's funeral last year. Jill wanted a lasting memorial.
2 months later, a year later, 2 years later, you'll never know when someone's going to run across it And that's a wonderful thing.
Memorials like these are scattered online and getting popular. Jeff Taylor wants to bring them all together and steal away the death notice dollars that newspapers get. Taylor's known for starting Monster.com and moving the Help Wanteds online. In June, he'll launch Tributes.com to do the same for death notices.
It's a well-read section. You know, they sometimes call it the Irish sports pages, or somebody said it's the way I keep score.
Taylor thinks he can score by creating a website where people will pay to post photos and comments and sign up to get emails, for instance, when someone from their hometown dies. He says that goes beyond the typical newspaper blurb that offers maybe a few survivors' names and an old black and white photo.
Very tough to draw your power as a person from such skinny details.
For now, newspapers make a fat $500 million from those skinny details.
A very small ad costs a lot of money.
Lou Urenik is a former newspaper editor. He says most dailies consider obituaries journalism and print them free of charge, but not everyone gets an obit.
And the only way for some families to get the names of their loved ones into the newspaper is to buy the death notice.
Phone in one to the Boston Globe, and it'll cost you $8 per line and $75 per photo per day. Even so, funeral directors say there's a reason newspapers have a death grip on the business. At his funeral home near Boston, David Walkinshaw says when people want to know for whom the bell tolls, they read the paper. Just look at the customers.
65 or 70, and traditionally they've done things a particular way. And when I put a newspaper notice in the Boston Globe, that's where people go to know that the visiting hours are at a particular point in time.
But Tribute CEO Jeff Taylor is banking on aging baby boomers who use the net more and more. He's hoping by the time he dies, Tributes.com will have become the clearinghouse for online death notices.
My favorite song is Michael Jackson, Wanna Be Startin' Somethin'. And my favorite food is lasagna and garlic bread. There would be some sort of a montage or collage of things that mattered to me that I had more choice in, I think, than we see today.
He's already planning his own web memorial. In Boston, I'm Kurt Nikisch for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
These final notes before we go today. Boston's mayor wants to nickel and dime the general public into helping with the city's finances, quite literally. Mayor Thomas Menino proposed new rules today that would double most parking fines in the city. Parking your car in a handicap ramp used to cost you $50. Now it's up to $100. Parking in front of a fire hydrant will be $100, too. Thank you very much. Menino says it'll generate an estimated $13 million for the city. And do you worry about those home videos from your past popping up and embarrassing you? Walmart's feeling a little bit of that "oh no, we didn't" embarrassment today. About 30 years ago, the retail giant hired a video production company to tape meetings and other functions with top executives. Unscripted and unguarded meetings, we should tell you. One of them apparently has male managers in drag leading employees in a corporate cheer. Now the video production company's made its 15,000 tape library public. Going to make some money off it, too. 6 months of broadcast rights go for $7,500. That is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rolled down 49 points, 0.3%. The Nasdaq shrunk 26 points, 0.1%. The S&P 500 tumbled 11 points, 0.8%. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, hospitals push slumlords to clean up.
They have a choice to make. They can either spend the $50 and fix the leaky pipe and clean it up, or they can go to court with a lawyer. And they certainly don't want to do the latter. It's too expensive.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.